Welcome to Defenders, the teaching class of Dr. William Lane Craig. Today, a question and answer session with Dr. Craig. For many more resources, go to reasonablefaith.org.
I was saying we've been looking at the cosmological argument. We first did the contingency argument. Now we're looking at this form of the cosmological argument, which has three basic steps. Whatever begins to exist has a cause. The universe began to exist. Therefore, the universe has a cause. And I suggested that the really crucial premise or step in this argument is the second one, to show that the universe began to exist. And over the last 2 weeks, you have been looking at two purely philosophical arguments against the infinitude of the past. These are arguments that are very ancient. They go all the way back to early Christian thinkers who were responding to Greek philosophers who thought that the universe was eternal and infinite. And these arguments then were developed during the Middle Ages and continued on into the modern period. And some of us, at least, still think that these are good arguments, including myself. Now, what I want to do, I think, before we go into the scientific confirmation of these two philosophical arguments, is simply ask if there were any questions left over that you might have had about these that you didn't get to ask because I wasn't here in person, but you saw them on tape. So let's take the first argument based on the impossibility of the existence of an actually infinite number of things. The first argument goes like this. An actually infinite number of things cannot exist. A beginningless series of events in time involves an actually infinite number of things, namely past events, and therefore a beginningless series of past events cannot exist. That is to say, the series of past events must have had a first event. There must have been a beginning, a first event, and therefore the universe began to exist. Now, is there any question that anybody wanted to ask about any of those steps in that argument before we move on? Yes, Steve?
I was actually just wondering if you could tell us what an event is.
All right.
What I was thinking of was the relationship, say, between the Father and the Son. Is that considered to be an event?
Good question, because I didn't define that term. I would define an event as that which happens. So an event is a change. Now, we can specify some sort of an arbitrary standard for an event, say something that would happen in 1 second, say. And then what you will do is you will calculate the number of events back in the history of the universe, and the argument is that can't be infinite. So an event is that which happens. That means it's some sort of a change, and we can just specify any arbitrary event as our standard event, and then ask how many of these have happened prior to today. So it could be 1 second, 1 minute, an hour, a millisecond, it doesn't matter. But an event would be a change. So in that sense, the relationship between the Father and the Son isn't an event, at least on standard understandings of the Trinity. That is a relationship that isn't something that involves a sort of transition or a happening. So this is talking about changes that take place in the universe, things that happen before and after. That's what we mean by an event.
So then does it follow that you can't have an event without creation?
Well, okay, the question was, could you have an event without creation? I think that you could, because there are such things as mental events as well as physical events. Just close your eyes and count silently to yourself. 1, 2, 3. That would be a succession of mental events. So there is a kind of mental series of events that are going on in one's mind as well as the events in the physical world. And so we could imagine God or angels, say, counting prior to the beginning of the universe, in which case there would be a series of events. They would be non-physical events. They'd be purely mental events in the mind of either God or of an angel. Okay?
Doesn't that count against this argument then?
No, because the argument is there can't be an infinite number of those. There would, if God started counting, he would have to go, 1, 2, 3, boom, or something like that. But it is suggesting that there couldn't be an infinite regress of mental events either. Now, remember when we talked about divine eternity in this class. We talked about God's relationship to time. I argued that God, without creation, is timeless, in which case there isn't a series of mental events in God's mind prior to creation. Creation is just the beginning of time. And God, without creation, just exists changelessly and timelessly. So time begins at the moment of creation. But what you asked me was, could there be mental events prior or apart from physical events or prior to creation? And my response was, yes, there could be. But I'm not saying there were, but there could be. Right? Okay, Cindy?
It seems to me that this argument, an actual infinite number of things cannot exist, is really in line with the existence of the beginning of time.
Right.
Once you have time, events start, and without time there was no event.
Right.
So you're saying that there was a beginning of time.
Right.
And a beginning of, therefore, creation.
Right.
Would someone argue that that is not correct? I mean, are there arguments that time, I guess, and existence has been infinite? And therefore there's no God because...
Sure, sure. I mean, this is the traditional... What atheists have traditionally believed is that the universe is eternal and uncaused. It's always been there. And therefore there's no need for a creator.
Therefore, they would not agree with your first premise.
Right. They would not agree with that. But, I mean, it's not a matter just sort of opinion. I gave an argument for the first premise. You recall the absurdities that would result if an actually infinite number of things could exist. And it's very interesting when you read the writings of certain philosophers who are atheists and believe the universe has always been around there. On the rare occasions that they do address this, and I'm thinking here of somebody like David Hume. David Hume was a great 18th century skeptic and atheist philosopher. Hume admits that the existence of an actually infinite number of things is absurd and that it would involve irreconcilable contradictions. And yet he never seemed to reflect on... Yeah, he didn't connect the dots. But I can show you the references in Hume where he says this. It's quite remarkable. So, yes, they would disagree with that first premise, 2.11. But that's, I mean, anybody can disagree with anything. The question is, what is the grounds for your disagreement? Okay, good questions. Anybody else have a comment on this first one? Okay, well now the second one is independent of the first one. The second one says, all right, maybe an actually infinite number of things can exist, but they cannot exist by adding one at a time. One after another. So 2.11 says an actually infinite collection of things cannot be formed by successive addition, that is, adding one member at a time, one after another. 2.12 says the series of past events is a collection formed by successive addition. The series of past events up to today has been formed by one event after another being added to the series. One event happening on the heels of another. So that is the way the past is formed, is by successive addition. And it follows logically, therefore, the series of past events cannot be actually infinite. Any question about that argument that you heard about last week? Okay, don't be afraid to ask. I mean, yes, see?
Are you saying that with the second argument, you don't really ask the possibility of an actual number of, an infinite number of actual events?
What I'm saying on the second argument is that it doesn't deny that there could be an actually infinite number of things. Say an actually infinite number of marbles, or an actually infinite number of books, or an actually infinite number of chairs. It's not denying that. But what it is saying is that you couldn't form a collection of an actually infinite number of marbles or chairs by adding one marble after another, or one chair after another, one at a time. That it would have to just be created all at once by God simultaneously. God would say, let there be, boom, and there would be an infinite number of marbles. But you couldn't form a collection like this by adding one member at a time. We saw that this is sometimes called the impossibility of traversing the infinite, or the impossibility of counting to infinity. Imagine a string of dominoes that is infinitely long, would the last domino that's here in front of us, would it ever fall? Because before it could fall, the one before it would have to fall. But before that one could fall, the one before it would have to fall. And before that, the one before it would have to fall. And it goes back to infinity. It never has a beginning. So how could the domino ever fall? That's the kind of illustration that you see here in trying to form an actually infinite number of things by successive addition. Or you remember that funny cartoon that we distributed of the guy standing with the box, says, one infinite universe, and he's looking at it and says, open at the other end. Well, it's impossible. He can't, you know, get to the other end to open it. Yes, Scotty had a question, I think.
There was no time until creation. Time did not exist until creation.
Yes, except watch your word until, Scotty, because that word until is a temporal word, you see. So you'd have to say there was no time without creation.
Time as an element of our universe had a beginning. God decided, or God created it. And prior to that, there was no time.
Well, now, again, Scotty, you have to be careful here. You can't use the word prior. See, because that's a temporal word, like until. So you have to say, without the universe, there was no time.
This is like a one-armed wallpaper hanger.
Yeah. Well, see, the reason I'm doing this is just because I don't want your next question to be, well, then that's contradictory, you know, what you're saying. Because you're right. If you use words like prior and until, you're going to get into contradictions because you're going to have a time before time.
Question.
Okay.
Is God infinite?
Is God infinite?
Yes.
This is a very good question, and I'm glad.
Oh,
okay. I think God is infinite, yes. But when we speak of God's infinity, it is not a mathematical concept. It doesn't mean an actually infinite number of definite and discrete finite parts. And that's why I word this in terms of an actually infinite number of things. God is not composed of an actually infinite number of finite parts. When we speak of God's infinity, this is not a quantitative notion, it's a qualitative notion. And it means things like this, that God is necessary in his existence, that he is uncreated, that he is morally perfect, that he is omniscient, that he is omnipotent, that he is omnipresent. So the infinity of God is simply a way of expressing this idea that God is the greatest conceivable being and has all of these superlative properties. It's not a mathematical concept.
I'm trying to see God as in a timeline.
All right.
You know, the universe had a beginning. Then a decision was made on the part of the Almighty to create the universe. What was he doing prior to that?
Well, there was no prior. See, that's just it. See, Augustine said to those who asked about what was God doing prior to creation, he said we shouldn't just tell them the easy answer that he was preparing hell for those who pry into mysteries. Rather, Augustine said that time had a beginning at the moment of creation, and then therefore there is no before. So the question is a meaningless question. There isn't any such moment. Now, you could say, well, what was God doing without creation? Well, I would say, without creation, God exists in the fullness of the love relationships between the members of the Trinity. The timeless, full blessedness of God in the love of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit for one another.
Answer her question so I can get off this hook.
All right. Cindy.
But in a way, we are insinuating that there were events prior to time, prior to creation.
Well, no, I don't think so, because
you're saying, I mean, think about the whole essence of Satan, the fall of... There seemed to be this cosmic war of good and evil, and how evil came to be in Satan. That happened prior to creation, I think.
Yeah, well, we don't really know when this happened.
Insinuate that there were events prior to creation.
Well, We don't really know when things like the angelic fall took place. We just know that by Genesis chapter 3, Satan is on the scene, and he's in there. But as Bryant said, we really can't date this. So it could be that Genesis 1:1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, was the creation not only of all physical things, but of all angelic realms as well. And sometime after that, there was the fall of the angelic persons. Now, if you want to put it before creation, then you could say there were these angelic realms that existed prior to the creation of the physical universe, but there's no biblical reason to say that. So I think for simplicity's sake, just start with Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, and that's when everything began. But we don't really know when the fall took place.
So are we saying that the qualities of God are His essence? There's no... I think of it in a vacuum, in a sense that when He... In other words, how am I trying to... Time in creation, there was nothing prior to it, which in my mind is a vacuum. Except God, in the sense essence, which was holiness, goodness, truth, and I guess we're talking about the triune God. Prior to...
Well, here, again, I know this is it's hard to imagine, but there you shouldn't think of this nothingness as sort of like this empty vacuum prior to creation. There's just nothing. There's nothing prior to creation because there is no prior, you see. Time begins at the first moment. So, and this is, let me just say, this is not a peculiarly theological doctrine. I mean, Augustine enunciated this doctrine, that there is no before, there's no prior to creation. But this is also what modern cosmology believes with respect to the Big Bang theory. If you say, well, what was before the initial singularity, the cosmologist will say, that's a meaningless question. It's like asking what is north of the North Pole. There just isn't any such point. So let me make a differentiation that might help here, Cindy, between chronological priority and causal priority. God is not chronologically prior to the beginning of the universe. There is no such moment. It is the beginning of time. But God is causally prior to the origin of the universe in the sense that the universe is an effect of God.
And Scripture supports that because in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with that form. So it almost describes prior to creation.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Prior in a causal sense. Sure, it says, all things came into being through Him, and without Him was not anything made that was made. So clearly God is causally prior to creation. But you mustn't think of that as a sort of chronological priority. Now, this is, again, a kind of a subtle distinction, but if you wrap your mind around it, you can see that it does make sense, and that the idea of thinking of God as, say, 1 hour prior to creating the universe, or 1 year prior to creating the universe, waiting for it to happen, that's purely a product of the human imagination. There is no such moment. Yes, Doug?
Two comments dealing with today's sermon. When Brian said that this war, this battle happened before creation, he had to admit the physical creation, right? Because otherwise Satan would be uncreated.
Right, yes, good point. Yes.
To me, I think that addresses Cindy, that it wasn't, when he says creation, he had, that he's playing with definitions of creation and not defining it very well. My second question is, when you talk about the first premise of your second argument in the video last week, you brought up some philosophers attack this premise on the grounds of their definition of time being static versus...
Oh, yes.
Today, Brian mentioned viewing the view of prophecy that God sees things in the past, in the present, in the future.
Uh-huh.
It sounded very static to me. How did you...
Boy, you're a good listener. I'm impressed. Right, I caught that too. What Bryant was endorsing was a view of the timelessness of God, that God sees past, present, and future as all sort of equally real. And you remember our discussion of divine eternity in this class, and I said that is one option, but that view does make sense, I think, most on the sort of static view. we can imagine the static view as looking sort of like this. Let this be space and time, which begins, say, at the Big Bang at T equals zero, and then it ends here at the Big Crunch at T equals N. And the horizontal dimensions would be space, and the vertical dimension here will be time. And it's very easy to think of God as existing outside of space and time, and he would know and be causally related to everything in time and space. And if this is us here in 2004, God would know and be interacting with things later than in our future, well, as well as things in our present, and as well as things that were earlier than or in our past. So on a static view, it's very easy to make sense of this notion of divine timelessness. But I do think it's very difficult to make sense out of that view on a dynamic view of time according to which only the present exists. And so the view that I suggested in class, which is not gospel, I mean, it's just my studied view, but you're free to reject it or accept it as you want. My view was that God is timeless without the creation, without the universe, but then he enters into time at the moment of creation and is in time then and related to the creation from then on out. So he's timeless without creation and temporal since the moment of creation. Yes?
Could he be both in the sense of God the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost? For the Son is in the time and the Godhead is external to that.
I don't think... The suggestion was that... Mm-hmm. Right. The suggestion was that maybe it could be both. Maybe the Son and the Spirit are in time and the Father is timeless. I don't see how you can make sense of that, because then you would have to say that I think you could put the human nature of the Son in time. You know, Jesus of Nazareth, his physical body. But what about the Logos, or the word that John talks about in John chapter 1? Isn't there a time before which the Logos was not connected with the human body of Jesus of Nazareth, and a time after which he was intimately related to the human body of Jesus, in which case even Christ in his divine nature would have a before and an after, and therefore would be in time. So these are very difficult questions, but it doesn't seem to me that that view makes good sense.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I appreciate that.
Okay. Oh, well, no, I'm not speaking, this is your view, you know, this, you just raised a question, yes.
Years ago, wondering about these things, I looked up time in my index, and I've always remembered this, what it says, and it says time, the period between two eternities.
Huh. Okay. Yeah, the question here was, she says, is time... What is it now? The period between two eternities. Yeah. Okay. Well, now, see, you could kind of make sense of that if you think of this as eternity, this causally prior state, not temporally prior, but causally prior state of eternity. And then suppose God brought the universe to an end and had eternity that was causally subsequent to the universe. Then I suppose you could make sense of time as the period in between two eternities. But I don't think that's a biblical view. Because, you see, the Bible says we shall live forever. God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish, but shall have everlasting life. So this model that I drew of time here was just for convenience. In fact, time will go on forever, because we will have everlasting life in a resurrection body with a new heavens and a new earth. Now, wait. She asked, could we live in an eternity without time? Not unless we were like mannequins in a store window that were frozen and never moved, never did anything, so there was never any change of before and after. But that's not what the idea of a resurrection body is like. A resurrection body is a body that is pulsing with power, with God's Spirit. Think of Jesus risen from the dead. That's a foretaste of our supernatural resurrection bodies. So the Christian vision of eternity is very different from this Greek notion of a timeless world where the disembodied soul will go off to contemplate God timelessly. The Jewish and the Christian view of immortality is a resurrection physical body that will exist in relationships with others and that will inhabit a new heavens and a new earth. So, I mean, this is hard to adjust to, those of us who are used to thinking of this Greek idea of disembodied souls being timelessly with God. But the Jewish Christian idea of eternal life is a very physical idea, and therefore will be a temporal life. Time will go on forever, I think. Okay, now, was there... Yes, David.
I have a question going back to the logic of my 2.2. So argument 2.1 I like very much because the conclusion is that a beginningless series of past events can't exist, and we're trying to prove that it can't be a beginning, so this makes sense. But I'm a little confused about the conclusion of 2.2, which is that therefore the series of past events cannot be actually infinite. Mm-hmm. I wasn't sure we wanted to prove that. How does proving that help us?
Well, I take it that if the series of past events is not actually infinite, then the only other two alternatives is that it's finite or it's potentially infinite. Now, it couldn't be potentially infinite because for time to be potentially infinite, it would have to be at every point finite but growing in a backwards direction, which doesn't make sense. Time goes forward. It can't grow in a backwards direction. So that would mean it must be finite. But if there's a finite number of past events, then there must have been a beginning, I take it. Right? Or I mean, how could you have a series of finite number of past events and not have a beginning?
I guess it almost seemed like the argument as stated presupposed that we did have a beginning and that we couldn't have gotten an actually infinite number of events. After that,
okay.
Last week, yes. Said, well, okay, but then if we sort of turn it backwards,
right.
Then...
This is a very common objection to the argument, and the objection is to premise 2.11. They'll say, yeah, you can't form an actually infinite collection of things by starting at a point and then adding one thing after another. You'll never get to infinity. But what you can do is never start and just finish at a point. And that way you can form an actual infinite by successive addition. And so I gave some arguments to try to show why that second method I thought was just even more unbelievable than the first method. It would be like the series of dominoes that you see now the last domino falling, even though before it could fall, you know, an infinite number would have to fall prior to it. It seems to me that if that series is infinite and it never had a beginning, that makes it even more difficult to see how that final domino would ever fall. And if you say it would fall, then you're confronted with the question, well, why didn't it fall yesterday? If it could fall an infinite time, then why didn't it fall yesterday? Infinite time was already done by then. In fact, why didn't it fall the day before yesterday or the day before that? And what you discover is there's no point in past time at which the last domino would fall because it would have already fallen prior to that. And that contradicts the hypothesis that the dominoes have been falling from eternity. So I think that idea is even more difficult than the idea of starting at a point and getting to infinity. Yes, Bob?
A clarification for a very practical application. There are two scriptures that came to mind when you were distinguishing between chronological and causal. The scripture says that Christ was slain before the foundation of the world. That's a time... evidence. And then in the baptism of Jesus, when the voice is heard from heaven, it's God speaking and so forth, and most translations render that, this is my beloved son in whom I am well pleased. It's actually historical present. It could be translated whom I was well pleased. Are those time references just for our understanding convenience, and does it really refer to a causal thing and not mm-hmm. a real chronological?
No, I think it's really, really important to understand that the Bible is not a philosophy book. It's not a book on philosophical theology. It's a book written in ordinary language for ordinary people. And so in the same way that Scotty and Cindy found it difficult to talk about this, about God, without using words like, well, prior to creation or until creation, the Bible uses this kind of ordinary language too. So it'll say things like, before the foundations of the world, God existed. Or in Jude, there's a wonderful doxology at the end of the book of Jude where it says, to Jesus Christ be glory, dominion, power, and authority, both before all time, and now, and forever. And I take that to be just kind of your ordinary language way of speaking. It would be ungenerous to accuse Jude of logically contradicting himself by saying before all time. We all understand what he means. He means that time has a beginning, but that God didn't have a beginning. And so God is beyond time in some way. And that's the way I would take these passages. I think that they do teach that time had a beginning, but that God didn't have a beginning. And so in ordinary language, you would say God existed before the time began. But if you want a different preposition, rather than before, I like the word beyond. You could say God existed beyond the Big Bang, if not before the Big Bang. And that would indicate his kind of causal priority. Yes, Mark?
Comment on the definition of time. She said that it's a space between two eternities. Isn't saying two eternities in and of itself a contradiction, and that you can only count a finite thing? And an eternity being infinite.
Well, this is a very... This is a very, very interesting and difficult question that he's asked about, could there be two eternities? This is a question, could God create time, be eternal beyond time, say he's without the universe, he's timeless, create time, and then could he destroy time and revert back to a state of timelessness?
Well, couldn't time be a finite subset of an eternity?
No, no, not in the way she's talking about. I mean, here we're talking about eternity as timelessness.
Right.
I mean, if you think of eternity as being timeless, then that's just a continuation of the same dimension and the same directions. But the interesting question is, could you have timelessness, then time, and then God revert back to being timeless again, so that sandwiched between two eternities would be this time? And I think that's an open question. I'm dubious that that's a coherent idea. But this is something that is worth really thinking about. And I know of one medieval philosopher, Al-Ghazali, who is a Muslim philosopher who dealt with this sort of question and had some very interesting things to say about it. And I actually read a paper on this at a philosophy conference last December, where the way Al-Ghazali distinguishes between these two eternities is not by saying one was before the universe and one was after, because that would be contradictory, right? That's using these temporal words again, before and after. But the way he distinguished, I thought it was brilliant. He said, the way you reach the one eternity is by going in the earlier than direction until you hit the beginning point, and the way you reach the other eternity is you go in the later than direction until you can't go any further. And those are clearly two different eternities, because you reach them in different directions. So, you know, that's a really interesting idea, but we digress, I think. So, any other question about these arguments here, the second philosophical argument? Obviously, it does raise provocative questions about the relationship between God and time. Yes, Steve?
One more question related to time, not the arguments. What would be the use of attributes like omniscience and, you know, all those types of attributes, you know, before creation or beyond creation, whatever you say?
Well, okay, the question is, what would be the usefulness of the attributes like omniscience and omnipotence beyond creation, God existing alone? Well, let's think about that for a minute. In order to create the universe, God would have to have all this power, right? So it is omnipotence which makes him able to create the universe out of nothing. Indeed, it's hard to imagine a greater power than the ability to create the universe from nothing. That would seem to require omnipotence, right? So his omnipotence is what makes him able to be the creator. Now, what about omniscience? Well, remember that our discussion of omniscience that we had, God's omniscience, I think, includes not just knowledge of everything that is the case, but remember also he has middle knowledge. And remember what that was? That was God's knowledge of what would be the case if something else were to be the case. So it's God's middle knowledge in this state beyond creation that enables him to weigh all of the different possible worlds he might create and say, well, you know, if I were to allow Pilate to be the procurator of Judea in AD 30, and if I were to have Herod be the king, and Jesus were to be sent then they would send him to the cross, and in that way I would achieve the atonement for sin. Well, see, that he has to have that knowledge prior to, in quotation marks, prior to creation, in order to be able to create a world of free creatures that will turn out as he wants to. So his omniscience is vital to God in this state of existing beyond creation, in planning a world of free creatures that will arrive at his ends. Keith?
Let me ask a question. I hope we'll clarify this a little bit. Is where we're getting hung up on this notion of there being no time without creation and God's existence, is it helpful to remind ourselves that God's knowledge is simple, that he does not acquire knowledge one concept after another like we do, but his knowledge simply is there? So for him, he didn't have to go through a series of mental events and parsing through the alternative to reach this creative act. For him, it simply was.
Yeah, that's a good point that Keith is reminding us. Because God is omniscient, he knows everything. So he never has to reason from premises to conclusions the way we do, because he already knows the conclusions as well as the premises. So God's knowledge can just be a sort of simple intuition of all truth, and he doesn't have to have this mental sequence that we finite beings do when we learn by inferring conclusions from premises. So that's a good point. All right, any other question about these arguments for the beginning? All right, well, remember, these can be very simply presented. You don't have to get real complicated. You don't even have to give all these steps. The first argument you could say to someone something like this: well, if the universe never began to exist, there's been an actually infinite number of events prior to today. But isn't that a contradictory idea? If I had an infinite number of baseball cards and gave you half of them, then how many would I have left? I would still have an infinite number left. But if I gave you all of the baseball cards higher than the number 4, how many would I have left? Well, I only have 4 left. And so you have a contradiction. Infinity minus infinity is infinity, or infinity minus infinity is 4. It shows that this idea of an actually infinite number of things is absurd. Or with the second argument, you could just simply ask them a question: if the past is infinite, then how did today ever arrive? How did we manage to get to today if we had to go through an infinite number of events prior to today to get here? And just help the other person to think about that a little bit. So I think you can understand these arguments in a deep way. That's what I want you to be able to do, but then just share them in a more simple way, just by asking questions like that. Okay, well, next time we'll look at the scientific confirmation for these philosophical arguments, and what we'll discover is that, shockingly, 20th century cosmology has come to provide scientific evidence for this conclusion that the universe began to exist, which the Judeo-Christian faith has always affirmed in the face of ancient Greek atheism and modern materialism and idealism, and now science is beginning to affirm this truth that Christians have always believed. So what we'll do next time is look at some of the scientific confirmation for the beginning of the universe.
The copyright for the content of this recording is held by Dr. William Lane Craig. For more, go to reasonablefaith.org.